but is a publication that has a little credit among literature circles in the world, and particularly economic circles. They had an article on the 27th of March last year called Finances of the Catholic Church, page 1403. The stocks and bonds of this holy Christian religion of the poor people amounted to only, this is the Roman papacy, the papacy itself, has stocks and bonds amounting to only $5,600,000,000. $5 billion. See, that's almost as much as Rockefeller family has. $5,600,000,000, just stocks and bonds. This is a conservative estimate. The land and real estate holdings plus the art treasures are valued at even greater than $5,600,000,000. The property, that is the real estate and land of the ecclesiastical bodies, the bishops, the cardinals, the colleges, which as property is independent of Rome, have a far greater value than the value of the stocks and bonds and all the property and real estate in the name of the papacy itself. So you can imagine the great, fantastic wealth of this poor man's religious leadership. The Morgan Group in this country handles the Catholic Church's holdings, the papacy's holdings, and the Rothschilds in France handle it for them there. In Italy alone, the Catholic Church owns 1/15, that is the papacy, not the individual cardinals and bishops and so forth, and the colleges and the convents that are endowed by people when they're on the deathbed. But the papacy owns 1/15 of all the stock on the Italian stock exchange, valued at about $600 million just in Italy alone. Poverty-stricken Italy, can imagine us. They own $600 million there. Another way that their wealth has accumulated, besides getting some poor devil on his deathbed and telling him, "Now pat me by, you led a bad life. You took a swing at your wife every once in a while. And instead of giving her some money to light a candle down in church, you bought yourself a bottle. So now I get the pipeline to God and I'll get you there, provided you give her some dough. Sure, you own your house. Wouldn't it be nice if you turned it over to the Holy Mother of the Church?" Well, that's how they did it in the days of feudalism. And that's how they do it today. As Omar Khayyam called it, threats of hell and hopes of paradise. And in addition to that, they have the little ceremony called baptism. And they have noveners where you can go down. And if you go down so many days, I don't know, say Wednesday for about 15 weeks, and you kick in a little donation, you can get your wish fulfilled. You pray to the Blessed Mother, you pray to God himself. If he isn't too busy, he'll pay attention. Otherwise, you turn it over to one of his saints. If you don't believe me, ask Anatole France in Penguin Island. He'll explain everything to you. And then they have candles. That they used to, when I was a boy, they used to sell them for 10 cents straight. Now they sell them three for a quarter. And as soon as you go out of church, they blow them out. Now, we can laugh, you know, when we think of this. But I'm not talking through my hat. When I was a young boy, I was a choir boy up in the Mission Church here in Roxbury. Big monument up there to ignorance, built by the Irish immigrants. When I was a young boy, it was the wealthiest church in New England. And we used to watch the priests, these poor people, you know, during Mass, before Mass, would go down and light candles, or after Mass, they'd go down and light these candles at the altar. A dime a piece, three, in those days, dime a piece, see? And, well, sometimes we had to sing masses at funerals, which meant that we stayed at 10 o'clock. Sometimes stayed at 12 o'clock. There were a lot of funeral business was good, you know, like during the influenza of 1919, 1920. Sing 5 and 6 masses in the morning. It helps them get into heaven, you know. Well, anyway, we used to see these brothers. The brothers took care of the church. The priest didn't, but the brothers. They come out and they blow out all these damn candles that these poor people have paid a dime for, in good faith, thinking that they were lighting the candles to help somebody, get out of purgatory or get into heaven or something or other. These scoundrels, what a pack of miserable racketeers, that's all you can call them. Well, they have a big take on that, too. I was trying to come down to modern times. I don't mean Charlie Chaplin. It'd be good if Charlie Chaplin did something on the Christianity. With the development of capitalism and the Catholic Church turning itself into the best defender and the bulwark of defense of capitalism, came some other developments inside the church itself. And the greatest one was at a Ecumenical Congress in 1870, when the boys went into a powwow and they discovered that the Holy Father could never be wrong on theological questions. 1870. Hey, where were they all this time? 1870, they discovered the Pope cannot make a mistake in theological questions. And they also discovered that the Blessed Virgin was immaculately conceived. 1870. You know, when I was a kid, they used to tell us that all of these things were discovered by God. By that, we always thought they meant Christ. He passed the word around to his disciples and said, hey, you know, my mother was immaculately conceived. Well, you know, Alexander was divine too, you know. Alexander the Great. I don't mean the ball player, Alexander. But Alexander, the king of Macedonia, after his great victories, he became divine. And it was discovered that he was born of a virgin mother. In those days, in days of animism, the hangovers of animism at least, it was discovered that his mother gave birth to him through a snake fooling around with her ear. Now, God has strange ways, you know. You cannot. But was not Caesar divine? Were not all the Roman emperors divine and so forth? Well, they discovered that the mother of Christ was divine, too. She immaculately conceived. And this held up through right down to the present time, that the Holy Father cannot be wrong on any theological question. During the war, we had a fine, smart count who was the Pope. I don't know what his name was. But he was a nobleman. That was the Pope during the days of the last World War. And he stated that the Holy Father cannot be wrong on temporal matters, too. So see, when the Catholics start saying well, we get along later on. I'll explain later on. But don't forget that. The Catholic Pope said that he cannot be wrong on temporal matters as well as theological matters. Well, to come down to closer to today, historically speaking, the Roman Catholic Church rallied to the defense of capitalism late in the development of capitalism, looking over a long period of time. And hardly had they come to the defense of capitalism when the trade union movement and the working class political movement started to develop. 75 years at the most, we'll say, after the French Revolution. And they took up the cudgels in defense of capitalism by denouncing the trade union movement and denouncing the political movement of the downtrodden and the poor. The church that has dedicated itself to the welfare of the downtrodden. They were the enemies of the working class. And they soothed the mentality of the working class with the promise of pie in the sky. The great song that was developed in the IWW in the United States, written by Joe Hill. It was during this period and earlier, in the early days of the rise of capitalism, where everybody knows that the Catholic Church was opposed to slavery. Going back to the early days of feudalism, the Catholic Church was opposed to slavery. That is the Christian Church. That is, if they were Christians. If they weren't Christians, while it was practically the duty of a good Christian to enslave the enemy, and then you could probably educate the damn fool and teach him the facts of life by making them a Christian. But you didn't want to do that, because if you did, you'd have to free them. And that's how the so-called inhabitants of Russia and Eastern Europe became known as Slavs, because they were the main recruiting ground for slaves to the western section of Europe. The Catholic Church made money out of the traffic of African slavery. The Jesuits, the Dominicans, and the Franciscans, different orders of Catholic priests, had large holdings. Their convents did, and their monasteries had large holdings in the sugar plantations of the West Indies. And as you know, they only operated on slave labor. The Catholic Church lent its hand in reducing the inhabitants, the aborigines of the American continent, to slavery for the benefit of the Spanish nobility and the adventurers that came over here, starting with Cortez. In the United States, it took absolutely no anti-slavery stand at all. After the Civil War, it ran segregated schools and segregated churches. By its silence, it okayed the oppression of the blacks, and it okayed the reduction of the black citizen to a second-class citizenship. In the United States, they fought the trade union movement through the threats of hell and the hopes of paradise, that is, excommunication. If you belong to the trade unions, you were excommunicated by the Catholic Church. Let any Catholic deny it. He or she that denies that as a policy of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States is either a liar or an ignorant fool. They write mountains of books now explaining how they love the working people, the trade unions in the United States. Well, let them explain where they were when the working man had to fight with the possibility of losing his life and trying to organize a trade union. Let them explain why it was that when Jim Hill, one of the great early railroad capitalists, was building his Northern Pacific Railroad, he laid down the law to his superintendents of construction. The first thing you build in every road camp is a Catholic church. Oh, who was Jim Hill? What, one of the Knights of Malta or something? A big Roman Catholic? Jim Hill was an openly professed atheist. But he had a road gang made up of Irish immigrants. So bring the priest in here. Tell these people, don't worry about what I pay them. Their main worry is to get into heaven. And that's what happened. Let them explain why he wanted a little church built first before anything else was done. Let them explain why the Western Federation of Miners, probably the greatest fighting trade union that this country ever saw, let them explain why it was corrupted and took to the road of the right after the early 1900s in this country. Let them explain why the Catholic Church did its best to try to break the strike of the oppressed textile workers in Lawrence, Mass, 1912, That great strike that was led by Bill Haywood and the IWW. They had an article in the Boston Globe about 6 months ago, a big windy article written by some ignoramus, explaining about the great role that the Catholic Church played in Lawrence to not break the strike, they wouldn't dare mention those kind of words, but to educate the poor oppressed striking textile workers against Haywood and the IWW. When I was a young man, there was a famous bishop in Fall River here, Bishop Cassidy, our most outrageous strikebreaker in the textile industry in the United States. He used to go not only confine his activities to Fall River, but he would make a tour of the textile centers in Massachusetts and Rhode Island during textile strikes. This pig living in a big castle somewhere, I suppose, in Rome or down in Nassau, like this O'Connell that used to be the bishop here, the cardinal here when I was a young man. William O'Connell that came from Lowell, came out of the gutters of Lowell, became a cardinal by being a bootlicker to the rich and powerful in this country. That was his record. A black reactionary, came from working class parents and hated and despised his past, and hated and despised the working people. The only man when I was a young man, you could talk to anybody, I mean the Roman Catholics, you could talk to any Roman Catholic and tell them what a pig this man was, and he said, of course he is. You could tell them what a disreputable character he was, of course he is. You could tell them how he feeds off the backs of the poor people. Oh, everybody knows that. He had a castle in Rome. He had a big private home down in Nassau, the Bahamas. And in his castle, or his big home out there in Lake Street where Cushing holds forth now, he had nothing but Japanese help. Nothing but Japanese help. Valets, cooks, and everything else. You wasn't going to have some Irisher there. One of them might wake up someday and give stories about how the splendor that this monster lived in. Well, he was a great man for talking against trade unions and against strikes. Read the history of the steel strike of 1919, when these steel workers, working only 12 hours a day, one day off in 14. Hear what I said? 12 hours a day, one day off in 14, and they weren't satisfied. Can you imagine that? Read about their strike of 1919 and read who broke it, or who was the big ally of the big steel barons. It was a Roman Catholic Church allied with the Coal and Iron Police of Pennsylvania. That was the private police force of the coal operators and the steel the barons in the state of Pennsylvania. It was only dissolved in 1934. Who was it that fought the rise of the CIO? Besides the Henry Fords and the General Motors and Schwab of Bethlehem Steel, it was the Roman Catholic Church. That's who it was. But with the victory of the CIO and the spread of unionism in general among the working people of the United States, the Catholic Church flip-flopped and obeyed the old law of Tammany Hall, another fine, outstanding Catholic organization, which is, if you can't whip them, join them. And that's what the Catholic Church did. They fought the organization of the Automobile Workers Union and of the Electrical Workers Union. And we'll have more to say about that in a second. Now, what do they do in Europe? In Europe, they split the trade union movement. In all the great industrial countries except England and in Germany, Protestant Germany, they split the trade union movement and went into business on their own. You have the Catholic trade unions in France. You have the Catholic trade unions in Italy, created only after the rise of the regular regular trade unions built by the socialists in these countries. Today, of course, in France and in Italy, the Catholic trade unions are away to the left of the communist-dominated unions. They could stand still and be far to the left of the Stalinist trade union. In France, just think of this, comrades and friends. In France, the communist trade unions will break strikes called by the Roman Catholic trade unions. Peaceful coexistence. They have to bootlick the French capitalists with the hopes of getting a pact out of them, like they got one in 1935 with the French capitalists against Hitlerism. In Latin America, they are the main ally and support of capitalism and the big landowners. We can't say capitalism in Latin America, in a lot of the countries, you have a semi-feudal condition of huge, immense land tracts owned by individuals that practically control politically that whole section of the woods. And they hold those big land holdings mainly through the coercion of the Catholic Church against the peasantry. Anybody that's acquainted with the situation in Latin America knows that. Anybody that heard that really truly noble Felix McGowan on this platform, the ex-priest that had his experience in Brazil, anyone that heard him talk knows what I'm talking about. To think that these Roman Catholic priests would get down as missionaries to Latin America and hoodwink these poor unfortunate creatures, these peasants, suffering all kinds of horrible diseases, not to mention diseases of hunger and everything else, and would peddle to them the hopes of paradise, pie in the sky. Don't worry about your suffering here. The main thing in life is to get into heaven. So don't care about Joe Blow there that has that owns 300,000 acres of land. He'll have just as tough a job getting to heaven as you have, you know. Well, you know, when I was a little boy, I used to believe in Santa Claus, too. When I put on long pants, I try to think, too. That's why I'm here tonight. We see the latest developments in Latin America. Everybody knows, Wall Street knows just as well as we do, that socialism is on the agenda in Latin America. Wall Street thinks they can stop it, but we know they can't. Not because you want it, not because I want it, but because material conditions demand it. That's what the side thinks. Material conditions, that is hunger, and the drive for food, clothing, and shelter, and the fight against the lowering of the standard of living, which is continually going down since the end of the Second World War. This struggle to maintain food, clothing, and shelter is going to force the South American peasantry and the workers in Latin America to revolt against American imperialism and create a socialist Latin America. Nothing can stop that. Nothing. Now, the American capitalists have got their great ally in the Roman Catholic clergy and are now taking steps in Latin America to create Catholic political parties. We see what happened in Brazil, rather in Chile, with the creation of the Christian Democratic Party, and this is now the pattern to all of Latin America. Now that we have tried every kind of tricks in the bag to halt up the revolution, well, let's try a new trick, and that's creating the Christian Democratic Party. And the platform of this party will be, God forgive us, we're going to create socialism. But our kind of socialism, you know. And that's what they're trying to hoodwink the Latin American peasants and worker with. To get back to the United States. In the 1870s, in the 1870s we had a terrible economic collapse, you might say, in the United States. And millions of workers were unemployed. strikes that were terrifying, to say the least. Just picture all the railroads shut down from the East Coast right out to the Mississippi. Just picture one railroad depot after another being burnt to the ground by these well-fed workers. Just picture the militias and military shooting blindly into crowds of strikers and their sympathizers and so forth. Well, out of this came a revolt, a political revolt by the more or less advanced workers of the United States, who formed a political party called the Workingmen's Party. And one of these priests who was serving God and actually believed in the early sermons of the Catholic Church, blessed are the poor, for there's the kingdom of heaven, so forth and so on, took the logical step and went into the working class and became one of the spokesmen for the downtrodden workers of those days. He campaigned for the work in the working class party, working men's party. Afterwards, he campaigned in the Liberty Party, for the Liberty Party. And as a result of this, he was excommunicated. And that course befalled every priest of those days who dared to side with the underdog. It was during this period that civil rights and progress was never defended. The Catholic Church played absolutely no role whatsoever in any of the progressive moral ideas that popped onto the American surface in the whole 19th century. They opposed women's suffrage. They never raised a voice or a whisper about the thousands of working men that were killed by militia in strikes from the Civil War up to the present day. There may be an individual priest that speaks out of order, but I'm talking to the church. Did you ever hear of the Catholic Church raising hell about the lynchings that went on in this country? You Commodore and folks are old enough to have read the newspapers previous to the revolt of the Negro masses in this country. Did you ever read of the Catholic Church raising the devil about the lynching of these poor, unfortunate creatures in the South? You bet your life you didn't. Would have interfered with their business in the South. And if one of them did speak up, he was expelled or excommunicated. The same as Father McQuinn was. Now in 1936 and 1940, it's very interesting to know a few of these facts, you know, because of the mask that these scoundrels are wearing today. During the bottom of the Depression, when millions of working men and women and their children were living on a pretty tight diet, to say the least, when millions upon millions of working men had no jobs, when it was the height of foolishness to go in town to look for a job, because first of all, you didn't have the dough to go in every day, unless you got up about 4 o'clock in the morning and walked in. We used to walk in the daytime because we had all day to walk into Boston Common and sit down and listen to the bull and all the million and one debates and so forth that went on. But during this period when millions of workers were undernourished, underfed, couldn't find jobs, didn't have enough clothing on their backs for their children, their wives, and themselves, there arose a big political movement in this country under the leadership and the sponsorship of the Roman Catholic Church. I say sponsorship. They'll deny it, of course. This was a movement led by a fascist priest, Father Coughlin. He called himself Coughlin. You know, when you're up on the top, you change the name, the pronunciation of your name. You're no longer Pat O'Brien's son. You're now Mr. O'Brien. So Mr. Coughlin became Mr. Father Coughlin. Well, he was a priest out in Detroit in one of the suburbs. And he was quite a radio barker. He spent all of 1936, 1937, 1938, and so forth, 1939, fighting the Automobile Workers Union, the rise of the automobile workers, denounced them, said it's communist and so forth and so on. He said he was in favor of unions. Well, Hitler was too. Mussolini was too. That is good union. Meaning unions run by him, by the Catholic Church.